Ever wondered if you can claim discrimination in court, even if, well, your rejection wasn't solely based on that discrimination?
Yeah, it's a tricky question, right? Like, where does the actual injury lie?
Exactly. Today, we're diving deep into Texas v. Lesage, a case that tackles this very question. And trust me, it has crucial implications for how civil rights lawsuits are fought, especially for you future legal eagles out there.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission in this deep dive is to really understand the nitty-gritty of this Supreme Court decision and why it matters, particularly when we're looking at the intersection of equal protection, discriminatory practices, and the remedies available under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983.
Right. That's the big statute allowing suits against state and local governments for civil rights violations.
Yeah.
And Lesage is, well, it's a fascinating look at the legal concept of injury and discrimination claims. It forces us to consider, is the mere presence of a discriminatory policy enough? Or does that discrimination have to be the direct cause, the but-for cause of the harm someone experienced, especially when they're seeking money?
Okay, so let's set the scene. We're talking about Francois Lesage. He was a Caucasian African immigrant who applied to the University of Texas's PhD program in counseling psychology for the 1996-1997 academic year.
Right.
He got a rejection letter, and he believed it was tied to the university's race-conscious admissions policy they had at the time. So he sued, arguing this policy violated his fundamental rights.
But it's important to remember the context here. During that period, UT did consider race as one factor among several in its admissions decisions. Lesage argued that this very act, just considering race, was a violation of his equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And he backed that up with claims under several federal statutes, including 42 U.S.C. Section 1981, 1983, and also Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that's 42 U.S.C. Section 2000, which, you know, prohibits discrimination based on race, color, or national origin in federally funded programs.
So Lesage's core argument was basically, hey, the university considered race, that led to my rejection, and therefore I deserve compensation. But the University of Texas, they didn't just roll over, did they? They had a pretty strong counterargument.
They certainly did. The university's main point was essentially, look, Mr. Lesage, even if race had never been a factor in our admissions process, your application simply wasn't strong enough to get you in.
Okay.
They presented evidence comparing his application, his GPA, his GRE scores, the strength of his recommendations to those of the students who were actually admitted. Their argument was basically that his application wouldn't have made the cut regardless of the race-conscious policy.
All right, so this goes to court. The district court initially sided with UT, granted them summary judgment. For our listeners, maybe newer to legal procedure, summary judgment is basically when a court decides a case without a full trial because there's no, like, genuine dispute of important facts. So what was the district court thinking here?
Well, the district court essentially said that UT had provided enough evidence to show there wasn't a real disagreement about whether Lesage would have been admitted under a race-neutral policy.
No way.
They concluded that based on the strength of the other applicants and the relative weaknesses they saw in Lesage's file, his rejection was pretty much inevitable, regardless of race being a factor.
But the story doesn't end there, right? The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals took a look and reversed the district court's decision. What was their rationale?
Yeah, the Fifth Circuit approached it from a different angle. They essentially said that the very act of using race as a factor in the admissions process was itself a violation of Lesage's constitutional rights.
Okay.
In their view, the existence of a race-conscious policy was the central issue, and whether he would have been admitted anyway was, well, less important at that stage. They focused on the process itself being discriminatory.
Which, of course, tees it up perfectly for the Supreme Court to weigh in. And in a unanimous decision, they actually reversed the Fifth Circuit. So what was the key legal question that the Supreme Court was really trying to answer here?
The core legal issue, the one that landed in the Supreme Court's lap, was this. Can a plaintiff sue for money, recover damages under Section 1983, claiming a discriminatory admissions process, if it's pretty clear that they would have been rejected anyway, even without the allegedly discriminatory policy in place?
Okay, so it boils down to whether the discriminatory process itself, without a direct causal link to the negative outcome, the rejection is enough to warrant financial compensation. And to figure this out, the Supreme Court leaned on a previous really important case, Mount Healthy.
Exactly. The court heavily relied on the precedent set in Mount Healthy City School District Board of Education v. Doyle. Now, that case wasn't about racial discrimination in admissions. It involved a teacher claiming he was fired for exercising his First Amendment rights, believe it or not.
Oh, interesting.
But Mount Healthy established a key principle. If the government in that case, the school board, can prove that it would have made the same decision even without the unconstitutional motive, then they are not liable for damages.
Okay, so how did they take that principle from a First Amendment case and apply it to Lesage's equal protection claim about racial discrimination? That seems like a bit of a jump.
Well, the Supreme Court reasoned that the underlying principle of Mount Healthy, the need to show that the unconstitutional action actually caused the harm, wasn't limited to free speech cases.
I see.
They said it also applies to claims of racial discrimination under the Equal Protection Clause. They really emphasized the requirement of but-for causation for recovering damages under Section 1983. In simpler terms, Lesage had to prove that but for the university's race-conscious policy, he would have been admitted to the program.
And based on the evidence UT had presented about the other applicants and, you know, the parts of Lesage's application they argued were less competitive, the court basically said he couldn't meet that but-for causation standard for getting damages.
Precisely. The court concluded that the university had put forward enough evidence to show that Lesage's application just wasn't strong enough, and he wouldn't have been admitted even if race hadn't been considered at all.
Right.
Therefore, they reasoned the alleged discriminatory policy wasn't the direct cause of his rejection in a way that would justify awarding him monetary damages under Section 1983. This ruling essentially sets up this dual motive analysis in the discrimination context when you're seeking damages, forcing plaintiffs to kind of disentangle discriminatory reasons from potentially legitimate ones.
This seems like a really critical distinction for law students to grasp, especially the difference the court draws between seeking monetary damages, that's the backward-looking compensation, right? And seeking injunctive relief, which is more about preventing future harm. Can you break down why this distinction was so vital in the Lesage ruling?
Absolutely. It's crucial. Lesage's primary goal in this lawsuit, at least by the time it reached the Supreme Court, was to get money from the university.
Right.
The court made it very clear that when you're seeking these backward-looking remedies, financial compensation for past harm, the focus is very much on whether the discriminatory action directly caused that specific harm. Did it make the difference?
Okay.
However, they contrasted this sharply with claims for injunctive relief, where the plaintiff is asking the court to order the defendant to stop a discriminatory policy or practice going forward. For injunctive relief, the legal standard is different. The injury is considered to be the inability to compete on an equal footing.
Okay, so a lower bar.
Exactly, a lower bar than having to prove you would have actually received the benefit, like admission, but for the discrimination. You just have to show that the discriminatory policy prevents you from fairly competing for it in the first place.
In Lesage's case, if I remember correctly, he initially did seek both damages and an injunction to stop the race-conscious policy. But later he dropped the request for the injunction. He focused solely on the money.
That's right. And that ended up being a really pivotal strategic decision, especially in hindsight, given how the Supreme Court ultimately ruled.
Yeah, seems like it.
Because he was only pursuing monetary damages by that point, he absolutely had to meet that higher burden of proving that the race-conscious policy was the direct, but for reason he wasn't admitted. If he had continued to pursue the injunctive relief claim, the legal analysis would have been different, focusing more on whether the policy itself created an unequal playing field, regardless of his specific outcome.
So for our future lawyers tuning in, what are the really big takeaways from Texas v. Lesage? What's the lasting significance of this case?
Okay, well, firstly, Lesage really strengthens the Mount Healthy defense, specifically in equal protection cases where plaintiffs are seeking monetary damages. It essentially says, look, even if a discriminatory practice exists, if the defendant, the university here, can convincingly show that the same negative decision would have been made anyway for legitimate non-discriminatory reasons, they can avoid being held liable for damages.
That's a big shield for defendants.
It can be. Secondly, and this is key for any future litigator, it really underscores the absolute importance of proving that but-for causation in Section 1983 damages claims alleging discrimination. You have to establish a clear link between the discriminatory act and the specific harm you've suffered if you want monetary relief.
And the third major takeaway revolves around the specific type of legal remedy being sought, right?
Yeah.
The whole damages versus injunction thing.
Oh, exactly. Lesage clearly highlights the different legal standards and the different types of evidence you'll need depending on whether you're asking for backward-looking compensation or a forward-looking order to stop a discriminatory practice.
So different strategies required.
Totally different strategies. If you want money, prove the discrimination caused your specific injury. If you want to change a policy, the focus shifts to the fairness and equality of the process itself. And it's also worth noting, the Supreme Court didn't end the entire case. While they resolved the Section 1983 damages claim, they actually sent the case back down to the lower courts to continue considering Lesage's remaining claims under Section 1981, which deals with contractual rights, and Section 2000, which, as we mentioned, prohibits discrimination in federally funded programs.
Okay, so parts of it lived on. Let's delve a little more into some of the finer points.
Yeah.
The case mentions UT had a two-step admissions process. How did that particular structure play into the arguments?
Ah, that's a very insightful point. The university specifically argued that Lesage didn't even meet the initial academic cutoff. This first step was based on objective criteria like GPA and GRE scores, and it was applied to all applicants regardless of race. So their argument was, essentially, if Lesage's application was already going to be eliminated at this first race-neutral stage, before race even became a factor in the later, more holistic review, then the race-conscious policy couldn't possibly have been the cause of his rejection for the purposes of claiming damages.
So that two-tiered system was pretty crucial for UT's defense then.
Absolutely crucial. They argued his application fell below a threshold applied to everyone, making the later race-conscious review irrelevant to his specific claim for monetary damages.
And it's really important to emphasize, isn't it, as the Supreme Court itself did, that the Lesage ruling should not be interpreted as somehow endorsing or validating race-conscious admissions policies.
Absolutely not. That's a critical clarification. Lesage offers zero opinion on whether the University of Texas's race-conscious admissions policy was constitutional or not. The court's decision was very, very narrowly focused.
Just on the damages standard.
Exactly. Just on the specific question of what a plaintiff needs to prove to recover individual monetary damages under Section 1983 in the context of such policies, the broader ongoing legal debates about the permissibility of race in university admissions, well, they were simply not the central issue in this particular case.
So let's bring it all together. To summarize the core holding of Texas v. Lesage for our listeners.
Yeah.
If you're seeking financial compensation damages under Section 1983 for alleged discrimination, and the evidence clearly demonstrates that the adverse decision, like a rejection from a university program, would have happened anyway, regardless of the discriminatory practice, then you are, well, very unlikely to succeed in your claim for damages.
Mm-hmm.
When you're asking for money, proving that the discrimination was the direct but-for cause of your harm is absolutely essential.
That's a clear and accurate summary. This case really highlights the strategic considerations for legal professionals. When you're representing a client in a discrimination case, you need to carefully analyze, what remedy are we really pursuing? Are we trying to get compensation for past harm? Or is the main goal to stop a discriminatory system going forward?
Because the path is different.
Completely different. The legal hurdles you'll face, the evidence you'll need,
yeah.
It all shifts significantly depending on that fundamental objective.
So looking ahead and considering the Lesage ruling, how might legal challenges to university admissions policies evolve? Especially
yeah.
with, you know, all the ongoing national conversations about affirmative action and equal opportunity, what are some key strategic considerations plaintiffs and defendants might be focusing on now?
That's a really important question, especially for anyone interested in this area of law. Lesage definitely suggests that plaintiffs seeking monetary damages in similar cases will face a significant challenge proving the but-for causation, particularly if institutions can present compelling evidence of non-discriminatory reasons for their decisions.
Right.
This might lead to a greater emphasis in future litigation on maybe systemic challenges to policies, and perhaps a stronger focus on seeking injunctive relief aiming to dismantle policies rather than just securing individual financial payouts.
So attacking the policy itself more often.
Potentially, yeah. And on the other side, universities and other institutions will likely continue to meticulously document their non-discriminatory decision-making processes. They'll want to build robust evidentiary records to support potential unhealthy style defenses if they get sued. The legal landscape around university admissions and equal opportunity is constantly shifting, and Texas v. Lesage remains a really crucial piece of that ongoing puzzle.
Absolutely.
Texas v. Lesage serves as a powerful reminder, doesn't it? While the existence of discriminatory practices is a serious concern the law addresses, proving that an individual's specific harm was directly and causally linked to that discrimination, especially when seeking money, requires a very precise and rigorous showing under the current legal framework.
Well, thank you for joining me for this insightful deep dive into what is really a pivotal case in civil rights law.
My pleasure. It's definitely a case worth understanding.